Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll hear a great talk by sports commentator Dave Zirin on football and its connection to American culture and why abolishing the game is not the right answer or even the right question. I hope you'll stay tuned. It's early October, and I gather that football season is underway. I gather this from the weekly supermarket circulars, which are hyping stuff for us to consume on what they call game day. Soda pop, chips, or Doritos, frozen previously cooked farm-raised shrimp, football-shaped balloons with the name of your favorite team, and our own fresh store-made salsa. That pretty well covers the five basic food groups: salt, sugar, fat, cholesterol, and balloons. See, even if you haven't watched television for the past 20 years, as I haven't, you can still keep up with popular culture. To me, this is late harvest season or late bicycling season. But thanks to Stop and Shop, I understand that for normal Americans, this is early football season. Personally, I like professional sports even less than I like frozen factory-cooked farm-raised shrimp. But I do like the intelligent, socially conscious sports commentary of Dave Zirin. Unlike me, Zirin really likes sports, even professional sports, though he's scathingly critical at the corruption of the system. We'll hear most of a nice public talk Zirin gave just a few weeks ago. It's about football. He tells a fascinating story of the origins of this game. For Zirin, American football is the child of the ruling class, and U.S. imperialism, and what used to be called muscular Christianity. It's always been violent, always had a very high rate of injuries and fatalities, more or less on purpose, he says. Gotta toughen up those Harvard boys for imperial adventures abroad. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, subjugating the natives is hard work for manly men. Actually, we're still working on Tripoli, which happens to be just down the road from Benghazi, in Libya, of all places. But back to football. Zirin strongly dislikes what pro football does to the players, but he has no sympathy with the progressives who want to ban the game. Zirin's solution? The football field is a workplace. Let's fight for workers, all workers, to regain power to control the nature and conditions of their work. Sounds good to me. It also sounds a bit like socialism, but there you have it. The title of the talk is Violence in Pro Sports: How Much is Too Much? Here is Dave Zirin.
NBC Sunday Night Football is the number one most watched television show in the United States. The most watched television program in the history of this country was last year's Super Bowl. The second most watched was the Super Bowl the year before that. I mean, and it's so incredible because other sports in this country have actually declined in viewership, the major sports, basketball, baseball, hockey, the traditional big sports. But the NFL just keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's an incredibly influential cultural force, and we should have something to say about why it's so damn popular. It's also a sport that, curiously, is only popular in the United States. And that's very bizarre if you think about it, because other countries, you find people who, you know, love Hollywood movies, for example, or love hip-hop, or love basketball, but they hate the NFL as a point of pride. I mean, I have a buddy from Chile who says to me, he says, "We play football in our country," meaning soccer. "You guys play football imperialismo." Now, why is that? I want to talk about why that is. My second reason for focusing on football is that this question has become a political question. There's a big debate that's broken out among writers, journalists, serious thinkers, and Rush Limbaugh. And the terms of the debate are very simple. Given all we know about head injuries, should this sport be banned? Should there be actually a new prohibition movement or a new boycott movement against football? And I'm going to argue in this talk that both sides of this debate don't know their ass from their elbow. This is a debate that desperately actually needs to be reframed. So first, to answer the question, why is the sport so popular? The starting point is understanding the social roots of the game, because sports are a reflection of the societies that bring them up. And in our society, football's prominence rose as the United States developed into an industrial and military giant. I mean, after the Civil War, there was a staggering level of growth in this country. I mean, from 1860 to 1900, the population of the U.S. went from 30 to 75 million. New York went from 800,000 to 4 million. Chicago from 100,000 to 2 million. This was the era of booms for the rich and busts for everyone else. It was defined by strikes, instability, class war at home, and a new empire abroad. And the robber barons were obsessed with the idea that their own pampered, privileged children would be completely unprepared to navigate the violent world they'd helped create. And their concern bordered on the hysterical. This is what Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote in the Atlantic Monthly at the end of the 19th century. This is what he was, the father of the Supreme Court judge. He said, "I am satisfied that such a set of black-coated, stiff-jointed, soft-muscled, paste-complexioned youth as we can boast in our Atlantic cities never before sprang from the loins of Anglo-Saxon lineage." I don't know if anybody regrets that "sprang from the loins" is no longer used in popular writing anymore. Maybe we'll start a comeback or not. Now, in sports, particularly football, was seen as the answer for these stiff-jointed, soft-muscled children. And a word was actually created for people who didn't like football. That's actually the origin of the word sissy. So the origin of football comes with a lot of the origin of organized homophobia as well, to describe people who did not want to be part of this kind of violent contact. And so the birth of football, people assume because it's such a violent working class sport that it started amongst workers, but it starts at Harvard, Yale, Brown, and they started this form of rugby they called football that really didn't hold much of a relationship to the game today. It actually looked like something out of Braveheart. And you literally had dozens of kids dying every year on football fields at these elite institutions. And one writer put it very well. He said, "U.S. football was born in a morgue because they created these rules as a way to keep people from dying." And if you step backwards from this, you can actually see why so much of today's sports world is so incredibly twisted. I mean, the heart of the founding of modern athletics, modern football, was economic elites sending their children to die in Ivy League football games because they were terrified they would not be tough enough to lead conquests abroad and industrial brutality at home. And failure to do so made you a sissy. Ladies and gentlemen, the origin of sports in the United States. And this philosophy was proudly known as muscular Christianity. And it can seem like so much macho idiocy. I mean, muscular Christianity. And part of muscular Christianity was, as one writer put it, turning Jesus Christ into a sinewy stud. Like the pictures of Jesus is like buff come out of muscular Christianity. Like, if you ever see like a picture of Christ in your aunt's home or something, and you're just like, "Wow, Jesus is cut." That comes out of muscular Christianity. This period is when this art was created. And it seems like just macho tomfoolery, but this was about preparing the U.S. for empire. I mean, during this period, the U.S. invades the Philippines, Latin America, the Caribbean, and the values of sport were deeply tied to imperialism and war. And just as these ideas trickled down in society, football trickled down from the Ivy Leagues to being a club sport in large industrial factories. 1919 was the largest year in terms of number of workers who went on strike percentage-wise in the history of the United States. And in the 1920s is when you see football teams start at factories. And people were very explicit. Like, one industrialist said that we're doing this to calm the tensions of our workers. We need to give them creative outlets for their anger other than listening to communist doctrine. You know, all of this stuff you see. And a lot of the NFL teams that we root for now started as factory teams in the 1920s, like the Chicago Bears. Their original name was the Decatur Staleys, and they came out of the Staley plant in Decatur, Illinois. And it's a very short leap to go from muscular Christianity to factory teams to today's militarism at games, with warplanes flying overhead and the very language of sports being so infused with militarism. I mean, I would argue that football has always been about selling a supremely militaristic, twisted, masculine image of the United States back to ourselves. And this works its way into the very language. I mean, the late, great George Carlin said it very well. He said, "In football, the object is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assaults, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. Now, this goes right to today. I mean, after all, who tossed the coin at the 2009 Super Bowl? It wasn't John Elway. It wasn't Joe Montana. It was General David Petraeus. And so I understand why people say the NFL is in the business of selling war. But I would argue that the NFL doesn't sell war as much as it's selling a 13-year-old's idea of what war is. Like a highly commercialized, warped vision of masculinity defined by violence, defined by seeing depression as weakness, homosexuality as weakness, and seeking help from other people as weakness. And this is something that's very toxic. But what's interesting about 2012 is that NFL players are actually starting to talk about this. Brandon Marshall, who's a wide receiver in the National Football League, he wrote a remarkable op-ed after Junior Seau committed suicide. And he wrote, "In sports, those who show they are hurt or have mental weakness or pain are told, 'You're not tough. You're not a man.' And until last week, what we would hear, 'You are no Junior Seau.'" Now, despite all these distortions, the military ties to football and the way the Pentagon just humps the leg of the NFL like a dog in heat, football doesn't really explode in popularity until the 1950s and 60s when television brought it into American homes. And I would argue that you can't understand what makes football so entertaining without understanding what television adds to the experience. And I will say that I find the NFL on its own to be very entertaining as a commercial product. And I watch it, and I don't watch it for the violence, but it's actually when you watch it on television, I find it much less entertaining to be there in person. Because you watch it on television, and it's like every time a quarterback throws a ball, it's off camera. And so it's like, what's going to happen? So every play is like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? And it's uniquely made for television in that way. There are also, when you have players who can do it really well, like Michael Vick, who can dance between raindrops, or Calvin Johnson, who's known as Megatron, just the coolest nickname ever. I mean, these are players who athletically are thrilling to watch. It also involves strategy, camaraderie, and fun, which in our society can be in short supply. It's understandable why people on Sundays know where they're going to be, and that's on the couch watching an NFL game. And for those who dismissively call this the opiate of the masses, I would say, and your problem with opium is what? I mean, and I think what's difficult is that we need to reconcile the fact that football can be very entertaining and also reflect a value system informed by empire. It's warped by contradiction, but so much of culture under capitalism is warped by contradiction. Think about the music industry, which can mass produce both amazing music, but can also be just an engine of sexism or racism or homophobia. Or just think about what I think about a lot, which is like the perfect bowl of spaghetti and meatballs. I mean, it can be a work of art when done. Alex in the third row makes a beautiful bowl of macaroni and gravy. And it's like that I said that. That was almost Italian. Thank you. Thank you, Alex. And it's like the tomatoes that you're eating have been picked under evil conditions. The cows that went into these meatballs are probably pumped full of hormones and produced in a kind of conditions that would absolutely horrify you if you actually had to see the slaughterhouse. That's capitalism. Or the fact that my daughter loves Taylor Swift. I mean, Taylor Swift, I wish she loved Taylor Branch, but it's Taylor Swift. I mean, Taylor Swift writes her own music, plays her own music. She sings songs about, you know, girl power and whatnot. But Taylor Swift is also a blonde Cupid doll, and she weighs like 8 pounds. I mean, this doesn't mean you don't challenge these contradictions. You shout them from the highest hills. Like I say to my daughter, Sasha, Taylor Swift needs a snack. And that's okay. And the contradictions in the NFL are exploding. I mean, players, because there's been this whole discussion that's exploded about concussions and head injuries, players are more outspoken. The union is more outspoken. 2,000 players suing are fighting back, trying to change the culture of the sport. Their pain and their struggle have sparked a debate happening right now about the place and role of football in our lives, whether our kids should play, and whether we are watching something that deserves to be boycotted or even banned. And to be clear, this is a very good thing that this debate is happening. It's already forced the NFL to change some of their practices. I mean, this is a league that as recently as 2009 employed as their chief neurologist someone who was not a neurologist. As recently as 2009, their chief neurologist was a rheumatologist. And this rheumatologist sat in front of the U.S. Congress and said that he did not believe there was a proven connection between playing football and brain injuries. Seriously. This isn't 1809. This is 2009. And this debate has also emboldened the players' union in the last contracts to win unprecedented demands, limiting practices, limiting contact, improving helmets, winning the right to buy into their health care plan for life. Before the last collective bargaining agreement, every NFL player was actually kicked off their health care 5 years after retirement, no matter how long they played. And if you think about the pre-existing conditions, they wouldn't be able to get health care after that. No one would insure them. Now they can buy in for life. I mean, I knew a player whose wife got a job at UPS after 5 years because his medical, even though he made millions of dollars, they quickly went away in medical bills. They were bankrupt by the time he was 50 years old. His wife had to work at UPS so he would be covered medically so he could keep going to the doctor. That was the reality for far too many families. And it's also emboldened the union to stand up to efforts in the league to have an 18-game season, which is longer, or the sham bounty investigation of the Saints, which is pure unadulterated bullshit, which is not about player safety at all, but about the NFL covering its own. People have questions about it. We can talk about it. And it's making parents reassess if they want their kids doing this. I mean, there's a sea change of thought taking place. Think about what I said about football being so popular in this country. 1 million less kids were signed up for youth football this year than a year ago. And it's changed people's thinking. My father-in-law was drafted by the Dallas Cowboys. And he's gone in just the last year from saying that my son, who's 4, needs to play tackle football, to saying maybe we should keep Jake off the field. Or forget my father-in-law, Kurt Warner, for goodness sakes. A little more prestige than my father-in-law. He is a Super Bowl winning quarterback. He said he doesn't want his kids playing football. And this is a good thing as well. We should be having this debate, but unfortunately, the terms of the debate are awful, and this really shouldn't surprise us, because in this country, on its best day, official political debate is just awful. I mean, as Bart Simpson said, it manages to both and I mean, think about debates about the things that actually matter in our society, like health care, racism, war, the prison system. I mean, it's insufferable when you hear what are supposed to be the two sides debating this. And I would argue that the debate about football is no different, and all the more reason why it needs to be reframed. I mean, on the right, you have people like Rush Limbaugh saying that any effort to regulate football and apply the neurological science that we're learning is about a socialist, commie, feminazi plot to end freedom. And this is a quote from Rush Limbaugh on his own show. And I quote, "It's not going to be long before the wusses, the new castrati in our society, are going to suggest that football be banned, that tackle football be banned." At the risk of sounding violent, I'd love for Rush Limbaugh to exercise his freedom to play tackle football and meet a man named Ray Lewis. Now, Limbaugh also said, his voice dripping with contempt, or maybe OxyContin, hard to tell, he said, "What's going to happen is somebody's going to figure out here pretty soon that since 75% of the players in the NFL are African American, that 75% of the concussions are being suffered by African Americans, 75% of the heart attacks, early deaths, whatever." And then he just sort of trailed off. Told you, it was dripping with something. Now, two things about what Rush said. The first is that the number of African Americans in the NFL is 70%, but who needs facts when you're Rush Limbaugh? Second, I mean, does institutional racism as well as poverty play a role in why African Americans are 70% of NFL players? Of course it does. I mean, I asked a coach in Gulfport, Mississippi, why so many football players were African American, and he said, "When you have poverty, racism, and year-round sunshine, you have the perfect soil to grow pro athletes." But one thing Limbaugh is poking at that's actually true is that the view by a lot of people who are making the banning argument is that players somehow need to be saved from us or from themselves, from the bloodthirsty mob. And I do want to say that being an NFL fan does not make you part of a bloodthirsty mob, unless you're a fan of the Philadelphia Eagles. It just doesn't. Sorry. Okay. Put that in there last second. I was like, that'll be funny. It wasn't. Now, the most prominent spokesperson for the banned football argument is a writer by the name of Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell is the celebrity author of bestsellers like The Tipping Point and Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking, and other books that are like Explaining the World Through the Miracle That is Ketchup. Gladwell is the most prominent public intellectual arguing this. And his argument is that football is like dogfighting, another barbaric sport that was once legal, but which we have evolved as a society and now look down upon and criminalize. He implies that players are like the dogs, good people bred to be violent, who need to be saved. And as he wrote in the New Yorker, he said, "In a fighting dog, the quality that is prized above all others is the willingness to persevere, even in the face of injury and pain. A dog that keeps charging at its opponent is said to possess gameness, and game dogs are revered. Professional football players, too, are selected for gameness." Now, I would argue that this argument is condescending and reeks of class arrogance as well as racism. I'm sorry, but comparing people to dogs is absolutely obnoxious. Athletes are workers. They happen to work in a profoundly unsafe workplace, but they are workers. And honestly, to those who make the Hunger Games argument, I would say that if you want to organize against unsafe workplaces where people die because of unsafe conditions, there are many more productive places to turn than the National Football League. I mean, the U.S. has the most unsafe workplaces in the industrialized world. And more U.S. workers died on the job in 2011 than U.S. soldiers have died in Afghanistan and Iraq since 9/11. So a little bit of perspective, please. And then there's the argument on the prohibition side that's more abstract. It says, we live in a culture of militarism and violence, and banning the NFL is about taking on this culture of violence that surrounds us all. I mean, the idea that somehow if we ban the NFL, we are somehow confronting this culture of violence is ludicrous. I mean, this country is not violent because of the NFL. It's violent because we live in the heart of a global empire that thinks nothing of slaughtering hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq and Afghanistan or sending unmanned drones to kill entire families who get in the crossfire of presidential kill lists. I mean, we live in a country that thinks nothing of jailing 2 million of its own citizens. And if you want to confront this culture of violence, I would suggest that you start there. Now, I think the best approach, and I alluded to this before, is like to see pro football as a profoundly unsafe workplace. That's what it is. It's not a plantation. It's not dogfighting. Players aren't dogs. We should support the players' union's demands that players have the best health care and as few practices as possible. We should expose the lies of NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and owners that he is somehow concerned about the health and well-being of NFL players. We should raise our voices and challenge what we don't like about football to change. And the idea of fans organizing actually has a rich history that goes back 100 years, and there's no reason not to revive it. Now, Eugene Debs, by the way, socialist leader, turn of the century, for those who don't know who that is. Got 1 million votes in prison in 1920, amazing orator, amazing speaker. Debs also was somebody who hated booze. He said he wanted to fight for a world where people didn't feel the need to drink, which is not necessarily what I'm fighting for. But his position on prohibition, I think, is a model for us today when we talk about this. It's hard to find this stuff. My dear comrade, Scott McLemy, who's the one to go to, he found this letter that Eugene Debs wrote to the head of the prohibition movement about why neither he nor the Socialist Party would be a part of the prohibition movement. This is what Debs wrote. He wrote, "I admit all you say about the liquor evil, and we differ only in the way this evil will be destroyed. Prohibition will never do it. There is but one way to get at the evil, and that is by abolishing the profit system, at which intemperance is the legitimate fruit. Socialists are right in refusing to be led away from the main issue and to give attention to the thousand and more ills that flow from capitalism, private ownership, profit, and exploitation. For reasons of my own, I am opposed to the principle of prohibition. Theft and murder are prohibited, but it is to be doubted if these crimes are lessened by any appreciable extent on that account. The world pays too much attention to the effects while it ignores causes, and this is as true of the liquor evil as it is of any of the evils that afflict society." I mean, and he's right, of course. What does prohibition do? All it does is drive a practice underground, and when it's driven underground, it makes it less safe. Randy here is from Texas, and one could imagine a world of speakeasies underground where little kids are playing tackle football against each other, completely unregulated, and you need a secret knock just to get in to the Dallas basement to watch 7-year-olds knock each other silly. I don't know if that's an ignorant view of Texas, but no, that sounds, she's like, that sounds right. And in contrast, 5 minutes, good. In contrast, Pop Warner, which is the big league for youth sports, just this week, it was fortunate with doing this talk, in response to the science, said that they were going to have now full-scale regulation, eliminate contact and practices, et cetera, to try to eliminate the kind of subconcussive hits as much as possible. I mean, once again, it's a safer cigarette, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think we need to fight for more knowledge on this on its own. And we need to know more about the neurology. We need to have neurologists who aren't paid for by the National Football League or the U.S. Armed Forces. Those are the two leading engines of money for people finding out what are the real effects of concussions. People who treat what's called TBI in the Army, traumatic brain injury, and people in the National Football League. And obviously, I mean, call me crazy, but I think this kind of science is highly biased against seeing people actually get treated for their injuries. So this leads to just the last question here. If football is so popular, and this is a question you know you get in a lot, usually at a bar, would it exist in a socialist society? And I know some people are like, oh, geez, that question. But I would make this case here. I mean, football is so much a part of the American fabric. When this fabric is eventually torn asunder, will people still want to play? I think that's the starting point. And the answer is maybe. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. That's going to be up to the people who create this society to decide. But I can guarantee that the sports we play, whether football or not, will be more humane. I can guarantee that no one will play because they feel like it's their best shot out of poverty. And I guarantee that the sports we play will reflect a world where freedom is not warped to mean the freedom to inflict pain or hurt other people in the hopes of making money. And if there is a form of football, it won't be a sport that reflects the values of empire. And that brings us back to Junior Seau and this mystery of why he took his own life. And I'll end with this. I mean, I'd be negligent in talking about Seau's suicide if I didn't point out that he is Samoan. And Samoan men have the highest suicide rates on earth. I don't know if people knew that. And I interviewed a Samoan journalist about why that was after Seau's suicide. Why do Samoan men have the highest suicide rate on the planet? And he said to me, he was very upset. He knew the Seau family. And he said, it's what happens when you colonize and humiliate a warrior people. And he said, it happens when you colonize and humiliate a warrior people. I think about that you a lot, because the you is the United States. The you is its agenda, its values, and its concept of freedom, which means more and more the freedom to work and the freedom to die. And any country that exists on a foundation of exploitation and empire needs to be challenged in our culture, in our workplaces, in our locker room, and in the streets. Because as Frederick Douglass said, you know, this is a country that would shame a nation of savages. And that's not about football. That's about everything from the rooter to the tutor. And it's why we need to stand up strong and powerful and challenge this no matter where it rears its head. So thank you very much.
Dave Zirin, with a view of football somewhat different from what you'll find on Wide World of Sports. I condensed Zirin's talk a little to fit our time slot. You'll find a link to the uncut version on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Zirin spoke at the Socialism 2012 conference in September, and I speak from the East of the River Satellite Studios and Skunk Works of WWUHFM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Thank you for listening. You'll get to my non-carborundum, and if I don't drop the ball, talk to you again next week. Ciao.